Welcome to The Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by two of my great colleagues, Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you this fine Monday afternoon?
I'm okay, Nicholas, and yourself?
I'm not too bad, considering it is a Monday. And Mr. Marius Ruit, who is joining us back from holiday. Marius, how are you? How was your holiday?
I was good. I was in Mpumalanga for a week, and I have to tell you, you wouldn't think the country's on the brink of collapse. The place was quite busy. Most of the shops I saw were open. So yeah, maybe, who knows? Maybe there still is hope, but maybe that's also straw clutching again.
Well, we shall see. So let's start off with a bit of news from the weekend. And we did talk about this last week with our CEO, Frans Cronier. And this is the DA's virtual congress. So the DA had its federal congress, which it has every 3 years to elect its leadership, decide on resolutions for the party, and sort of chart its direction going forward. It was a virtual congress, which I think is the first of its kind in South Africa. I don't think a party's ever done something like this. Used voting software to capture the results from delegates across the country. It had the thing was held in multiple places, and this was, I think, part of the whole social distancing thing. It saw a contest for leadership as well as resolutions to be adopted from the floor. And to no one's surprise in particular, John Steenhuisen won the leadership contest, securing about 80% of the delegates, with 88% of the delegates apparently casting their vote. And he is now officially the leader of the Democratic Alliance, no longer just the interim leader. The results also saw Helen Zille being re-elected as the Federal Council chairperson, which is the position that she was elected to just before the departure of Musi and Athol Trollope. Contrary to what some cynics expected, Mbali Ntuli, who is John Steenhuisen's opponent, pledged her support for the party's newly elected leader. Talking about herself here, she said, "I think the future for me is incredibly bright. I'm going to continue serving the people of KZN who elected me to be in the legislature, and I'm going to make sure that I'm behind the decisions of the party in whichever way we want to make South Africa more prosperous, especially as we go towards next year's elections." There was, of course, heavy media criticism of the DA for electing a white leader, which I think was pretty... There was an awful lot of that from people like Karima Brown and Stephen Friedman, who said that the party had made a wrong turn by not electing Mbali Ntuli. There were also various resolutions on the floor of the Congress, and they were very numerous and very varied. Some were things like, do you condemn farm murders, which obviously passed overwhelmingly in favor of condemning farm murders. And then there were ones which failed, like... There was a proposal to establish ecocide as a crime against humanity in South African law, and that resolution failed. So let me start with you, Terence. What do you make of this Congress? Do you think it went well? And what do you think of Steenhuisen's role as leader?
Yeah, look, I must say I try not to commit myself emotionally on these things. I must say that I did have a soft spot for Mbali Ntuli on the grounds that she actually wanted a public debate, which I thought is something that that could benefit our politics beyond the DA. So, you know, in that sense, had I been in the DA and a voting delegate, you know, my vote might have gone to her. I think what was perhaps more interesting was that there was no kind of air apparent in the way they've had in the past. It was pretty much clear cut that that Musi Maimane was going to be elected over Wilmot James, and Helen Ziller was a shoo-in favorite. Now, while Stiernhuizen was a favorite, I don't think either he or Imbali Ntuli had the kind of public profile and charismatic following outside the DA that made for a sort of obvious choice. However much of our media has taken to disliking Helen Ziller, she was very, very popular when she took over. You know, this idea that this was disrupting this dreadful old boys club, and you know, she was you know, the closest thing to a progressive candidate that was available. And then Musi Maimane, I seem to remember that Eusebius McKaiser once commented that as much as he dislikes the DA, he likes Musi. I'm not sure, that could be apocryphal, but the point is that you know, these people had had commitments that went outside the narrow party confines. I don't really think that either of the current two did. I think that I've followed the media commentary, particularly this morning, and there's the usual suspects about how, you know, saying how dreadful it is, and Stephen Kruger is saying this is probably going to cause a collapse of the DA as a party, and Rebecca Davis saying that, well, it's showing these factions and it's all dreadful. I think that there's actually quite positive that issues were put on the table and were discussed, and some accepted, some not. You know, surely that shows some sort of internal debate. You know, and I, there's a cynical part of me that can't help thinking that if everything just had been accepted by acclamation, we would have, aha, you know, there's no debate. It's all prescripted from, you know, from exactly the same people. I think for many of the commentariat, there's a sort of phrase: if this is the sort of thing you like, this is the thing you like. Or maybe rather it's converse: if this is the sort of thing you dislike, this is what you will dislike. And the DA is sort of attached in the latter. I think it was also Mr. Kroetis who said that the DA is no longer sort of part of the rational center of South Africa's politics. It's veered off into the onto the fringes. But, you know, I think this showed a party that was still together, that was still functional, that was able to handle some of its internal stresses, and I think that was able to and I think, you know, if you see that in conjunction with the policy positions that have stepped outside of that consensus, if I can put it that way, it's a party that is prepared to buck conventional wisdom. You know, that being said, I don't think any of this, you know, says that it's plain sailing, and I think that there are serious problems within the DA that need to be attended to. I think keeping certain people off social, or should I say, anti-social media, might be a priority. But then again, I think very, very, very little of value comes out of Twitter. The question of the use of disciplinaries, which Bali and Thule raised, I believe, is apparently a very serious one. You know, I think that there is a credibility gap, whether it is the kind of credibility gap that your sort of lefty commentariat assumes it is. I'm not sure, but. Yeah, you know, we'll see in a couple of days, you know, with what the party standing with the electorate might be, and then going forward, you know, can they pass this into something into something marketable?
So, Marius, I want to go to you now. And firstly, do you agree with Terence's assessment there? And secondly, the next big test for the party is going to be in the by-elections, which I believe are being held on Wednesday. You can correct me if I'm wrong there. And so it's a week of a lot of elections. We're having DA Congress on the weekend, US elections on Tuesday, and by-elections across South Africa, I think 100 of them on Wednesday. So I think this by-election is going to be an almost immediate test of where the party is going electorally. So a number of questions. Firstly, do you agree with Terence's assessment of the Congress? Secondly, do you think that this Congress has happened far enough away from those by-elections to have to draw any meaningful conclusions about it from whatever the results of those by-elections are?
No, I think Terence is right. And this conference or Congress, I think, reflects quite well in the DA. Also, I have to say one thing about Mbali Ntuli. I don't think I would have voted for her. Just from what I've seen and so on, some of her positions seem to be a bit too close to, you know, this American wokeness. But I do think it was actually very admirable of her that she's challenged John Steenhuisen and didn't let this just be a coronation. And she seemed to run a very dynamic and clean campaign. And I think that's something we really have to give her kudos for. And also, she was also a very gracious loser, which I think is also important. And she seems very dedicated to the cause of liberalism and the DA in general. So I think is probably somebody who's got quite a bright future ahead of her in politics. But also, I agree with Terence that I think the fact that that the DA decided not to have public debates was actually also a black mark. I think if the DA wants to be a party for all South Africans, or wants to be a party that governs all of us one day, then I think it needs to be put forward its proposals and its leaders to the general public. I was thinking of the example in the UK, the Liberal Democrats. They also just had a recent leadership election. And they actually, the two leaders they were running there, Ed Davey and Leila Moran, I think the lady's name was, who ran against each other, they actually had a public debate on the BBC. And I was looking at the stats. The Lib Dems are actually only the fourth biggest party in Westminster. And so in absolute terms, they're a smaller party than the DA. And the DA in the last election got 3.7 million votes in South Africa. In the UK, the Lib Dems got 3.6 million. So actually, in terms of overall size, they're almost exactly the same size in terms of support. So I think the DA missed a trick. And I think a lot of people lost some respect for the DA that decided not to have public debates. And I think that would have been very interesting for everybody to be able to watch those. And yeah, I think I do think this conference or this Congress took place a little bit too early to affect these by-elections. But, I mean, effectively, John Steenhuisen has been the leader of the party for a year now, whatever it is, since Musi Maimane resigned. So I think the character of the party and the shape of the party has been pretty much, you know, built around Steenhuisen so far. So, yeah, but we'll see what's going to happen. I think there's 96 or 95 by-elections on Wednesday. So it's obviously normally not that many by-elections, but a lot were postponed because of COVID and so on. And there's two municipalities where the whole council's up for election, Noosterberg and Pokwane in the Northern Cape. And then there's a whole bunch of by-elections taking place all over the country, I think just about in every province, and also a broad range of demographics. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens on Wednesday. I'm quite keen to see how the EFF will do, obviously, and also see how many places Herman Mashaba's Action SA is going to take part in and see how they do. So I think we've got some interesting things to look out for on Wednesday. But also I saw a lot of the commentators was also saying how white the leadership of the DA is and so on. But if we look at in actual terms, I mean, out of the DA's top 11 leadership now, there's six white people, four black people and one colored person. I mean, we shouldn't be looking at these kinds of things, but it is South Africa, so we do. So, I mean, by any definition, it is the most diverse leadership of any political party in South Africa. And I was also looking at the DA's provincial leaders now. Out of the nine provincial leaders, only one is a white person. So, I mean, Nick, you'll probably have more knowledge of this than me. I mean, I don't know how much power provincially the DA actually has, but imagine they've got some kind of influence and sway. And, I mean, the fact is, so one out of the nine provincial leaders is a white person. So, I mean, this kind of meme that the DA is only for whites or is dominated by whites, I think it's unfair. And, I mean, as Terence said, and the commentary, they really don't look further than, I mean, obviously the DA is now basically English version of AfriForum because they've got a white leader, which is of course, complete nonsense. So, yeah, but yeah, so we'll see if John Steenhuisen. I think he's got his work cut out for him. But I think it's probably a good choice for the party. And yeah, we'll see how he does in the next couple of years. He's got some hard work in front of him, I think.
Indeed. I think of all those by-elections, the one that's probably the most consequential is Ward 68, which is actually in Johannesburg. I've talked about it before on the show. It was a Rivoli, Westbury, that area of Johannesburg. it's extremely closely contested, about sort of, I think, 500 votes separating the parties. And so it's also important for control of the Johannesburg Council, because, of course, that is a council that is relatively close in terms of the DA and the ANC. It won't swing the council to the DA if they win it, because it was actually a DA seat until their councillor there defected to the ANC and helped vote in the new mayor. He was then kicked out of the DA, but it forced a by-election. I think I just want to kind of do a couple more things here. One is, I agree with you guys that the media commentary has really not been great. We saw this when the DA adopted its non-racialism policy. It's gone, you know, the criticisms are so sort of based on nothing. It's so difficult to kind of get a grasp on where exactly they're coming from. I mean, that comment about how the DA no longer forms part of South Africa's rational center of politics. Well, what's the rational center then by that logic? Does it start at expropriation without compensation?
If I can interject there, I think, if I remember correctly, Ms. Curtis's piece today was saying that the DA has moved to the right while South Africa's politics has moved to the left. I'm not quite sure what he bases this on. There seems to be a great deal of assertion without evidence.
Right. That's exactly an ANC-centric worldview, which is that – sorry, go ahead, Terrence.
Yeah, you know, I think let me use an analogy here. If one remembers that TV show The West Wing, which, you know, develops a sort of cult-like following, apparently the scriptwriters had in mind the sort of idealized version of the Clinton presidency. They took out all the sleaze and gave a bit more backbone or whatever, and you had this telegenic couple and whatever, which was pretty much what Clinton was seen as in the early 90s. And, you know, that was what you got. I think that a lot of commentators see South Africa in terms of this, let's say, this idealized ANC that, you know, maybe not expropriation without compensation or any given policy position, but it needs to have the ordinal features. It needs to be based on explicitly on race, or exactly what that means, you know, is somewhat woolly. At one point, when Mr. Maimane resigned, I do remember one commentator, and I forget who, said something about this is the moment of decision. You know, will the DA be some sort of right wing lunatic party or an ANC light? It was sort of like, well, it's one or the other. You know, you have to fit within the ANC's framework of analysis. I don't think that this is necessarily about necessarily fealty to the ANC as an organization, but to that sort of worldview and wanting to, and right. still regarding that as the default for South Africa. And that I think has probably been the ANC's most enduring imprint on the country. It goes right back to the early 90s. And I remember as a student at university during the transition, you would look with very little success for any academic source that would represent the ANC merely as one political party with a particular sectarian set of interests. At some level, the ANC was always the organic expression of the country, and everyone else had some sort of angle, you know, whether it was the Nats or the IFP or the DP or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you know, and this has survived into a lot of academic commentary. People, you know, you would think would know better, into the Mbeki presidency, where people could write articles and say things like, as President Mbeki recently reminded us, you know, then quote from a speech, as a, this settles the matter. Rona Kadali, you know, who of course had her own set of issues, you know, once called out someone else by saying, hey, you guys thought Mbeki was this towering intellectual, he was talking rubbish about AIDS. There you go.
Maurice, do you have anything to add?
I just want to say, Terrence, you're giving your age away when you say you were in university during the transition. I was in high school. I don't think you were even born then, eh, Nick?
I was born. I was just, I was just mastering skills like to walk and that kind of thing anyway.
No, but also want to say, I agree, nothing can be seen outside the ANC. Everything I mean, I've said this before as well. I think out of the 14 parties that are in parliament, I think only four don't have some kind of connection to the ANC as, you know, as in split off it from at some point or whatever the case is, or linked to it somehow, or being the split off of a split off from the ANC, what have you. And I remember a little while ago, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago now, I think it was the DA said they opposed to whatever B or something. And then the ANC spokesperson at the time said, how can the DA be opposed to this? It was as if the DA had committed heresy almost. And it was just, you know, like Terrence says, we're all part of this ANC universe. And, you know, thinking outside of it is, you know, like I said, it's like it's heresy. It's you'll get burnt at the stake for not thinking how the ANC tells you to.
Well, look, my sort of final word on this is that that I think was starting to break down under Zuma because he was so clearly an inadequate character. But I think Ramaphosa has been able to reinstall some of that faith in the ANC as a center of all that is great and good. Here's an interesting thing. You know that real 411 site where you can report fake news and hate speech and whatever? Look at the landing page. What's the image you see? It's President Ramaphosa standing behind a lectern. It then scrolls on to these various other images, but that is the only one that I think that appears to be a non-stock image. Now this is a page supposedly devoted to the truth, but part of its framework appears to be that you know, we are loyal to this, you know, to this figure.
So right. That's a really interesting point. Last thing I think I want to say on this topic is just a quick question to you guys. So as I said at the beginning, this was an entirely virtual Congress, and you can actually watch the entire thing on YouTube. I think all sort of 6 hours of it are on the SABC YouTube page. Yes, the SABC does in fact have a YouTube page.
And I'm going to find you to watch it.
soon, I'm sure they will. And I think... it's been quite interesting from a technical perspective how flawlessly the whole thing seemed to run. You had people all over the country, but it was well staged, managed. There was some spectacle. There were some speeches. It really was of a quality that I think matched or possibly even exceeded, like, for example, how the US did their virtual congresses this year. And, you know, having a little bit of experience with DA congresses in the past, I thought from what I could see, and I'm open to correction on this, that it was more focused and substantive than previous congresses of the party, and certainly compared to other parties like the EFF and the ANC, which are just sort of chaotic and big and complicated. So I think I'll start with you, Maurice. Virtual Congress, a thing that you think worked, could go ahead in the future, or do you think it's very temporary, that there'll never be aspects of this again?
I think probably in the future there'll be, I mean, a lot of people say we've got this new normal, but I'm pretty sure once COVID is out of the way, which will be one of these days, we'll go through, you know, some of the way we live will be changed. I think a lot of more people work at home and so on, but I mean, we'll go back to, there's going to be sporting events, there's going to be conferences where people get together. I mean, one of the things I'm sure, I think was Paul Pereira put on Facebook, who used to be involved with Institute, saying one of the problems with having a virtual Congress was that you lost a lot of the interaction, and somebody like Mbali Ntuli was challenging, not the incumbents, but pretty much the favorites, couldn't go and, you know, like press flesh with, you know, delegates and, you know, be on the hustings and speak to people about their votes and so on, so I think you lose something. And then, I mean, she could have maybe made up for the fact that they couldn't have these debates and so on. So I think there'll probably be elements of it, and there'll probably be, it'll probably be more common that anybody will be able to watch it. But I don't think this is going to be the template going forward. I think there'll be elements of it, but I think we'll go back to, you know, having the physical gatherings of people, whether it's political conferences or, you know, like say sporting events or whatever the case is.
Terrence?
I think that it's probably a huge money saver. Don't underestimate that. I remember some years ago going along to a DA Congress and hearing a senior official in the administration wagging his finger at the various helpers and said, "Don't mess this up because this will cost us 1 million rand." You know, I think that well, you know, don't mess it up because it costs R1 million. Maybe you can say, don't mess it up because it costs us a couple of thousand now. I do also think that there are possibilities for people to be involved who wouldn't otherwise be able to. You know, if you have to make arrangements to get from, you know, Messina to Cape Town, it costs a lot of money. You got to like find a place to stay and whatever. Just if you can do it online. I don't think it will displace the physical thing entirely, but I think that this opens up possibilities. Yeah, you know, also something that I really wish that the media could have spent some time discussing. Mm. You know, there's been a lot of talk about the new normal, and well, here was the new normal in action, but that seems to have been lost in denouncing.
Instead, we've got to hear the same shtick about how white people in leadership positions are bad. Anyway, let me move on then from that to our next story for today. And this is also, I think, from last week. Julius Malema is appearing in court. I believe this was on in connection with his alleged assaulting of a police officer, where him and one of his sidekicks, Ndlozi, allegedly assaulted a police officer. Critics of the EFF criticized them for using white lawyers. Malema was very upset about this criticism, and he responded, "There's some story going around that we are represented by white lawyers. It is true. They will represent us today to tomorrow and any time you want. No one chooses lawyers for us. We choose our own lawyers. And we know which one is the best way," Malema said. He went on to say, "We are not an anti-white organization. We are a non-racial organization and stand against white... And our stand against white racists is not a stand against white people." He then went on to say, "When we are losing cases with black lawyers failing to submit the simplest thing like one page, and then we must use the same person lose cases so that we can be projected as the most disorganized organization with no direction." So this, of course, prompted some backlash. Some people accused him of making anti-black comments, and I believe that there was a Black Lawyers Association or something that criticized him. Maurice, quite briefly, what do you make of this little controversy?
It's classic EFF doublethink. You know, they'll say we have to support black people and whatever you, and talk about black excellence and so on. But I mean, they're not obviously. I mean, I'm sure that there are countless brilliant black lawyers out there. I mean, EFF themselves used that guy, I'm going to butcher his surname now, but Timbeka Nkwakorbi, I think it is. But, you know, the guy who's done a lot of work on land and so on, I mean, they've kind of gave him his the reason he's become quite a well-known name in South African legal circles. So, I mean, there obviously are the excellent black lawyers out there. And, I mean, the EFF should walk the talk and they should support black lawyers and, you know, the black legal fraternity. But they don't because... What they're doing, they're looking for the best people for the job, or as they perceive the best people for the job, and they decided that it'll be white lawyers in this particular case. So it also makes a mockery of saying we need things like quotas in whatever, in employment or whatever the case is, you know. So, but I mean, I suppose it also tells you something that Julius Malema would rather go wear a Gucci shirt rather than go help an emerging black tailoring business, for example. So, but I mean, like I said, it's a typical example of EFF doublethink. I mean, they are the epitome of post-truth politics in South Africa. I mean, when it comes to post-truth, they're worse than Donald Trump, I think.
So, Terrence, let me move to you.
Them as fighting words.
I'm curious as to when the media is going to begin launching attacks on the EFF for embracing non-racialism, as Malema has just pointed out at this in this little comments he gave here. What do you make of the fact that that non-racialism as an idea is so strong that even the EFF has to kind of at least pay it some lip service?
You know, this is what I would describe as empty branding. You know, we all like non-racialism. You know, no one is going to be against non-racialism, but you know, behind the scenes, we redefine it into all sorts of creative things so that we can get the substance. I remember when I was a student, and Maurice is quite correct to point to my advanced and advancing age. The student residence I stayed in my second year, got a new housemaster, and this guy was a white chap, but had an impeccable set of struggle credentials. He was a liberation theologian, a friend of Chris Arney, and whatever. And I remember him requiring all the students to come to the dining hall because he wanted to say hello to everyone. And he laid out his vision for the way this would function. I remember two things very clearly. First of all, he said that as far as he was concerned, tobacco was worse than marijuana, and he was banning smoking anywhere except in your rooms, which really hit me hard at the time. And then he went on and said that he will not tolerate any racism. Race, he said, is a concept with no sociological value whatsoever, and he will not tolerate the merest suggestion of it. I wonder if that guy would not be shouted out of Dodge right now. I'd believe that. Yeah, he probably really walked the talk. And when he was hiding MK people and, naming his white children with traditionally African names in the 1980s, that was probably seen as being way ahead of its time. It was probably very edgy. Now he would be accused of all sorts of nasty things.
He'd be accused of colonialism and
cultural appropriation. Whatever, and it's tragic, but yes, the EFF can't throw the brand out, but they can try and gut the substance.
Indeed. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for listening. We will see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. I won't be here on Wednesday because I am taking the day off to stay up and watch American election results because. Apparently, I don't have a lot going on in my life. but we will keep coming to you through the whole week, and we will still have a show on Wednesday, although it won't be me hosting. Thanks very much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a good one.